are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 20th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for listening today, and for all those who filled in while I was away, a very big thank you. The highlights in today's paper under Business and Finance. Activist investor Jaina has built a stake in medical device maker Cooper and will seek a potential deal to merge its contact lens unit with rival Bausch and Lomb. Kering is in talks to sell its beauty business to L'Oreal in a deal that values the division at roughly $4 billion, in a move aimed at reviving the luxury giant's fortunes. A worker's discovery that 50,000 of her contributions to her 401k account were missing highlights a hidden risk in employer-provided retirement plans. The automotive industry is again being rattled by supply chain problems, this time as companies face major tariff hits and make a pivot away from electric vehicles. Amid an unsettling market stretch, investors are turning to stocks in healthcare, consumer staples, and other sectors that reliably make profits no matter economic conditions. China's economy faces a crisis of involution, a cycle of competition so fierce that it is destroying profits, driving a worker rat race, and fueling a deflationary spiral. Startups from Silicon Valley and beyond are racing to develop cheap, reliable systems to counter hostile drones that are appearing far from the war in Ukraine. Outsourcing services company Provolis is undergoing a rapid expansion by investing in rural communities where hiring often lags. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. Israel conducted dozens of airstrikes in Gaza and halted humanitarian aid after it accused Hamas of killing its troops in a major test of the fragile ceasefire. The window for extending billions of dollars in Americans' health care subsidies is closing rapidly as Democrats insist on a deal as a condition for ending the government shutdown. The nationwide No Kings protest against Trump drew a heavy turnout in a peaceful show of opposition to what demonstrators call an authoritarian takeover. Robbers broke into the Louvre Museum in Paris in broad daylight and made off with 8 pieces from a gallery of priceless crown jewels. Bolivia elected a centrist who seeks improved U.S. relations as president, ending 2 decades of socialist rule. Trump said the U.S. would cut off aid to Colombia after that country's president accused Washington of homicide over a recent boat strike. The U.S. is repatriating 2 people to Colombia and Ecuador after they survived an American strike and a submersible. Hundreds of communities across the U.S. have successfully fought proposed FEMA flood maps that restrict development and mandate insurance, despite the risks involved. Over 20,000 ads have aired this year that focus on transgender sports or bathrooms, as the GOP relies on the culture war theme in elections. The picture on today's front page shows a large multi-level building with a truck and a ladder going all the way up to the second floor. And around the base of the building are police. And that caption reads, "Quick hit. A portable furniture elevator remained outside the Louvre Museum in Paris on Sunday after thieves burst in through a window of a second floor gilded gallery and made off with priceless royal jewels in broad daylight, all in just minutes." And that headline, "In daylight raid, thieves steal jewels at Louvre." The article, "Royal jewels stolen in bold Louvre heist. Thieves use portable furniture elevator, angle grinder to get into Paris Museum," by Sam Schechner. Paris. Tourists were streaming into the world's most visited museum on Sunday when a group of thieves burst in through a window of a gilded gallery on the second floor and made off with a set of priceless royal jewels. It was broad daylight, roughly 10:30 a.m. local time, when four individuals driving two powerful motorcycles and a truck with a portable furniture elevator parked outside the Louvre Museum. Two of the perpetrators, at least one wearing a highly visibility yellow vest, used the furniture elevator to get to a balcony outside the Galerie d'Apollon, which houses France's crown jewels. French prosecutors and police officials said. From there, they used what appeared to be an angle grinders to cut through a window and get inside. Once inside the opulent gallery, the thieves threatened guards with the grinders and started cutting into two display cases containing Napoleonic and royal jewelry, looting pieces, including a large diamond-encrusted bow brooch that belonged to Empress Eugenie, Napoleon III's wife. Then, as quickly as they had entered, the thieves exited, fleeing on the two motorcycles via the roads along the Seine River. They were in and out of the gallery in less than 7 minutes. The crime, for all its speed, wasn't without errors. The criminals attempted, but failed to set fire to their truck, prosecutors said. And they dropped the crown of Empress Eugenie with nearly 1,400 diamonds before they sped away. It was found damaged, officials said. No one was injured. 8 pieces in total were stolen, including an emerald earring and an emerald necklace that belonged to Empress Marie Louise, as well as 3 jewels that belonged to Queens Marie Amelia and Hortense, prosecutors said. Israelis hit Gaza targets, interrupt aid flow. Military says Hamas attacked its troops, which group denies. Test for ceasefire. By Dov Lieber and Anat Pellid. Tel Aviv. Israel conducted dozens of airstrikes across Gaza on Sunday and halted humanitarian aid into the enclave after it accused Hamas of killing troops inside Israeli-controlled areas in what is shaping up to be the biggest test yet of the fragile ceasefire. The Israeli military said two soldiers were killed in southern Gaza, where militants targeted troops inside Israeli-controlled areas with an anti-tank missile and gunfire. Another soldier was severely injured, the military said. Hamas made two other attempts to attack Israeli soldiers Sunday, the military said. Israel decided to halt humanitarian aid following calls from Israeli politicians across the political spectrum for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to respond forcefully to the attacks against troops. Signaling an end to its response, Israel's military said Sunday evening that it had begun reinforcing the ceasefire after the airstrikes. Hamas's armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, denied mounting any attack on Israeli troops on Sunday and said contact with its fighters in Israeli-controlled southern Gaza has been cut off since March. We affirm our full commitment to implementing everything that was agreed, foremost among which is a ceasefire in all areas of the Gaza Strip, the group said. Congress running out of time to decide on health subsidies. By Lindsay Wise, Anna Wild Matthews, and Katie Steck Farrick. Democrats are convinced their party is well positioned to win this fight. Washington. The window for extending billions of dollars in Americans' health care subsidies is closing rapidly. Enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies are set to end after this year unless Congress acts, and open enrollment for insurance next year starts next month. Democrats have demanded that Republicans negotiate on extending the subsidies as a condition for ending the government shutdown, now in its third full week. Republicans recognize that many of their voters will be hurt by a cutoff in tax credits, but they say the program known as Obamacare needs major changes. Any deal to end the shutdown is expected to involve a fix on the expiring ACA subsidies, which flow to more than 20 million people. But extending the enhanced subsidies would be difficult to swallow for Republicans in Congress who have spent the past decade and a half railing against the 2010 law that passed and was later expanded with only Democratic votes. Actually being able to write something that can be put in effect between now and November 1st? I don't know how it gets done, said Senator Mike Rounds, Republican from South Dakota. There are fundamental differences between what Republicans want and what Democrats want on this issue. The fight is the latest turn in the Obamacare saga, which keeps re-emerging as one of Washington's most intractable policy conflicts. Democrats are convinced their party is well-positioned to win this fight. Polling has shown strong support for continuing the enhanced subsidies from Democrats as well as Republicans and independents. Democrats are confident that pressure will only grow on Republicans to save the subsidies the closer it gets to open enrollment for Obamacare on November 1st. GOP House leadership has kept the chamber on break since mid-September in a bid to keep the pressure on Democrats. There's an urgency here, and yet the House of Representatives is on this paid vacation out of town and out of reach, said Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from Connecticut. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican from South Dakota, says Republicans are open to talks on extending the subsidies only after the government reopens. Senate Democrats have repeatedly blocked a Republican bill passed by the House that keeps the government funded until November 21st. That's the conversation that we will have when the time comes, Thune says, pointing to possible changes to the ACA subsidies to lower cost and address alleged fraud and abuse. We can't do it while the government's shut down, he said. Thune has publicly floated an offer to vote on extending the subsidies after Democrats end the shutdown, without a guarantee that it would pass. But Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, said Thursday that Thune had never approached him with any proposal and insisted that Republicans need to sit down with Democrats and talk. It's a predicament for many Republicans who must reckon with the fact that a growing number of their own voters have come to depend on the subsidies, which would revert to lower levels and help fewer people if not extended. The enhanced subsidies spurred the number of ACA signups to more than double since 2021, largely in red states. If kept in place, the Congressional Budget Office estimates they would expand the federal deficit by about $350 billion over 10 years. What they're trying to do is kind of paper over the many inadequacies and failures of Obamacare by continuing to have more taxpayer money go to bail it out, said Senator John Barrasso, Republican from Wyoming, of Democrats. Barrasso, a doctor, has given the credits a new politically charged name, Biden bonuses. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Antidepressants are recast as hot lifestyle accessory. Influencers tout them, but side effects dismay many followers. By Betsy McKay, Shalini Ramachandran, and John West. Corinne Byerly, a stay-at-home mom, recalled days when she felt lonely, overwhelmed, and at times paralyzed with anxiety and self-doubt. Byerly, who had neither health insurance nor money for psychotherapy, said she was intrigued hearing a former MTV star talk up Lexapro on a podcast in 2023. She searched for the drug on TikTok, her go-to information source, and found hashtag LexaproTalk and similar niche online communities where women in their 20s and 30s praise the benefits of antidepressants. She posted a video asking for help, and someone recommended hers, a telehealth company. Byerly answered a questionnaire, and an online nurse practitioner prescribed a generic version of Lexapro. A bottle arrived days later. Byerly of Canton, Texas, posted TikTok videos of herself running to the mailbox for a pill package and taking a dose, using such hashtags as hashtag LexaproBaddies and hashtag GetHelpMama. In the months that followed, she gushed over the pills to thousands of followers. My medication quieted the noise I'd suffered through for years, she said in one video. For a time, Byerly belonged to a social media movement that has given antidepressants a makeover, from a stigmatized medicine to a healthy lifestyle accessory for enlightened and empowered young women. Millennial and Gen Z influencers, some paid by telehealth companies, evangelized antidepressants on TikTok and Instagram using such hashtags as hashtag live laugh Lexapro, hashtag Lexapro girly, hashtag Lexaho, and hashtag Zoloft gang, recasting the medications as pop culture touchstones. On TikTok, hashtag antidepressants has surpassed 1.3 billion views. Influencers show off prescription bottles, dance, and take pills on camera. Byerly touted benefits of the medicine, but later felt emotionally numb, had brain fog, and a loss of libido, she said. Byerly held off telling followers for months, reluctant to acknowledge her faded sex life and embarrassed about gaining weight. At first, Byerly made light of some of the side effects, telling her followers that overall, I feel like I'm doing really well. Byerly, 34, only recently revealed her true experiences to her nearly 11,000 TikTok followers, posting about her withdrawal symptoms, which included weeks of headaches. The pills helped initially, Byerly told the journal, but the side effects of it blew the whole thing up. The rosy picture painted by cheerleading TikTok and Instagram influencers glosses over potential adverse effects. Some suffered side effects that diminished rather than enriched their lives, but kept quiet about it on social media. U.S. carmakers overwhelmed by supply snafus. Ford started trimming output of Super Duty trucks at a Kentucky assembly plant. By Ryan Felton and Christopher Otts. Assembly lines inside a Michigan factory that churns out high-end Jeep SUVs ground to a halt last week and won't resume production until early next month. The cause, according to an official for the United Auto Workers, is a shortage of aluminum. Ford Motor paused production at three plants for the same reason. Between the two automakers, thousands of workers in Michigan and Kentucky are now collecting unemployment. The automotive supply chain, a sprawling web of companies across the world, is in focus in a way it hasn't been since the early 2020s, when a severe shortfall of semiconductor chips hobbled the industry. Auto executives routinely tout a lesson from that moment. Don't rely too heavily on any one supplier. Now supplies of multiple items are gummed up at the same time. The confluence of issues is once in a lifetime, said Sam Fiorani, an analyst with consulting firm Auto Forecast Solutions. We haven't seen this happen before. The lessons learned from semiconductors should have prepared the manufacturers for some problems in the supply chain. But all these at once are unforeseen and very difficult to navigate. All this is rattling an industry that has been hampered by billions of dollars in tariff payments and a costly pivot away from electric vehicles. Last week, General Motors said the EV pullback would cost it $1.6 billion. Stellantis unveiled a $13 billion U.S. investment plan that will help defray its tariff bill. U.S. car sales are on pace this year to end slightly above the 15.9 million sold in 2024, according to the S&P Global Mobility. Next year doesn't look promising. Total production and sales are expected to dip, with tariffs weighing more on automakers and the average price of a vehicle remaining elevated, now around $50,000. China grapples with involution choking economy, by Hannah Mia. China is gripped by an insidious problem eroding its economy, a cycle of competition so fierce that it is destroying profits, driving a brutal rat race among workers, and fueling a deflationary spiral. This is involution, a once esoteric term that has come to define life for many in China and capture the biggest problems in the world's second largest economy. Even as China pursues dominance in industries of the future, artificial intelligence, renewables, robotics, much of its economy is in a race to the bottom that threatens stagnation. Squeezed at home, Chinese manufacturers are exporting more and more, while governments around the world are complaining that an influx of cheap Chinese goods is hurting their local industries. The Trump administration is betting that these vulnerabilities give Beijing the weaker hand in negotiations and that the U.S. can inflict more pain on China by targeting its exports with additional tariffs. Generally, involution means excessive competition, but it has become a shorthand for a range of maladies, especially deflation and overcapacity. Global startups race to develop systems to fight drone threats. Western solutions include using lasers and even nets to fend off intruders, by Bertrand Benoit and Daniel Michaels. Startups from Silicon Valley to Europe and beyond are racing to develop cheap, reliable systems to counter hostile drones appearing over airports and global shipping lanes far from the battlefield in Ukraine. The systems explode, collide, fire pellets, jam radios, beam lasers, and even shoot nets like Spider-Man. The different approaches reflect the multifaceted threat. Hostile drones come in all shapes, sizes, speeds, and altitudes. Some attack while others snoop. They fly alone or in swarms. The setting also dictates the response. Thwarting battlefield attacks in Ukraine requires a different approach from protecting infrastructure against spying drones in a crowded European city. Whatever the situation, equipment must be deployable quickly against fleeting incursions and cost no more than its target. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization Secretary General Mark Rutte recently announced a new initiative to help alliance members detect and thwart incoming drones. Across NATO, governments and companies are racing to catch up with Ukraine, which has been forced by Russia's invasion and relentless attacks to innovate drone defenses. Most solutions are experimental and have limitations, from cost to range, scalability, and reliability. Experience shows a layered approach with several systems for detection and response is most effective. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. No King's protesters march against Trump. Peaceful rallies drew people from across the U.S. challenging government actions. By Owen Tucker Smith and Jared Mitovich. Hundreds of thousands of protesters thronged city centers and parks for a national day of No King's rallies, challenging what they say are authoritarian actions by President Trump, whom they portray as acting more like a king than a president. More than 200,000 demonstrators gathered in Washington, D.C., according to event organizers, while tens of thousands more packed Grant Park in Chicago and Boston Common. Participants topped 100,000 across New York City, according to the New York Police Department, which said it made zero protest-related arrests. As events dwindled into the evening, authorities in several cities said the rallies ended peacefully. From the editorial page, Governor Hochul tiptoes toward Mandani. Zohran Mandani proclaimed on the debate stage Thursday night that as New York's mayor, he'd push Albany to enact higher income and business taxes. Andrew Cuomo argued Mr. Mandani's tax plans are impossible and based on a myth. At one point, a moderator chose to speak up to point out to viewers that New York Governor Kathy Hochul has opposed raising the income tax. How confident are voters feeling about that? Ms. Hochul is no moderate, and while many New York City dwellers hope she'd be a good check on a socialist Mayor Mandani, don't bet on it. One of his platform proposals is to provide free child care, starting at 6 weeks of life, while also paying child care workers at parity with public school teachers. In a joint appearance Tuesday, Ms. Hochul embraced the idea. "He wants to work with me on this, and we don't have the details fleshed out," the governor said. "I think these are conversations that will happen in earnest on many policies post-election." She added that she had found Mr. Mandani to be eminently rational. "Is this the sound of a tax increase being hatched? Or has Ms. Hochul discovered a magical money tree somewhere in the Catskills?" One estimate is that Mr. Mandani's massive new child care entitlement could cost $6 billion a year. Mr. Mandani's socialist answer to paying for his plans is straightforward: more taxes. He'd lift the state corporate tax from 7.25% to 11.5%. He'd add a 2% surcharge on New York City residents earning above $1 million, pushing the top combined state and local rate to 16.8%. You would see New Yorkers on I-95 fleeing to Florida, Mr. Cuomo said in the debate. You have to be realistic with revenue. Ms. Hochul has seemed to agree. "I'm not raising taxes," she said in 2022. "Not raising taxes. Not raising taxes. Not raising taxes." Why? "Because we have enough to work with." After Mr. Mandani's primary victory, the governor waited nearly 3 months to endorse him, and she had sought to avoid being tied to his policies. Yet now she talks of linking arms, Democrats and socialists, to set up a huge new government benefit. Mr. Mandani also wants to make bus rides free for everybody, and he'd raise the city minimum wage to $30 an hour. Both of those ideas, in addition to his taxes, would need state support. Who'd have a stronger bully pulpit, Governor Hochul or Mayor Mandani? Resistance in Albany is otherwise scarce. Democrats hold more than 60% of seats in both legislative chambers, and they've consistently pushed for more taxes and spending. Assembly Speaker Carl Hesta has endorsed Mr. Mandani's tax agenda. Ms. Hochul might be worried about her own primary next year, when she's likely to face Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado, an avowed leftist. New Yorkers who hoped Mr. Mandani would be checked by Albany might want to contact a real estate broker in Connecticut. Zohran Mandani and the tax hike death spiral. Burden the wealthy too much and they flee. That's how socialists run out of other people's money. By Alicia Finley. Say this for Zohran Mandani, New York City's probable next mayor. At least the young socialist Democrat is candid about his intention to hike taxes. Not so the state's other Democratic leaders, who for years have paid lip service to making New York more hospitable for the wealthy and businesses, while they do the opposite. I don't want to lose any more people to Palm Beach, Governor Kathy Hochul said in June, 1 month after extending a tax hike on the state's top earners. We've lost enough. Yes, New York has. A report by the nonprofit Citizens Budget Commission this summer found that New York's share of the nation's millionaires fell 31% between 2010 and 2022. The state and city would have collected some $13 billion more in personal income tax revenue in 2022 had the share of millionaires kept pace with other states. In 2019, Governor Andrew Cuomo jeered in response to calls by progressives to raise taxes on the wealthy. Tax the rich, tax the rich. Come on, tax the rich. We did. Now, God forbid, the rich leave. 2 years later, Mr. Cuomo signed a law hiking taxes on the rich, increasing the combined state and city top rate to 14.8% from 12.7%. God forbid, more rich left. The former governor, running for mayor as an independent, recently defended the tax increase to the Journal editorial board. It was a temporary COVID tax increase because we were broke. We closed the whole economy, he said. There was nothing to trim, and we had no revenue. Really? State tax revenue had increased 9% between 2018 and 2020. When Mr. Cuomo signed the tax increase in 2021, Democrats in Washington had just enacted a $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill that included $19 billion in direct aid for New York City and state, plus tens of billions more for mass transit, health care, and schools. And whose fault was it that the economy shut down? Mr. Cuomo's 2021 tax hike, like others before it, didn't solve the state's chronic fiscal problems, which stem from bloated welfare programs and rich benefits for government workers. State Controller Thomas DiNapoli in August forecast a $34 billion deficit over the next 3 years, the largest as a share of state spending since 2009 financial crisis. This is despite frothy stock prices and frenzied financial deal-making that have buoyed Wall Street trader bonuses, capital gains realizations, and state income tax collections. The high times won't last. They never do. When markets eventually correct, New York Democrats will be hankering for another tax fix to feed their spending habits. Mr. Mandani would need state approval to raise income taxes in the city, and Governor Hochul has been cagey about whether she would go along with his proposal to impose a 2% surcharge on income over $1 million. That would raise the top rate to 16.8%, by far the highest in the country. A tax hike looks to be inevitable as long as Democrats control Albany. Some Democratic legislators are admitting as much, though they are trying to deflect political blame to Republicans in Washington. By their telling, federal spending cuts to Medicaid would soon leave them no choice but to hike taxes. In truth, federal Medicaid spending continues to grow. The GOP tax bill this summer merely ended the all-you-can-eat Medicaid buffet for states. Democrats' problem is that their insatiable spending appetite will always exceed the means to pay for it. Raising taxes only drives away the businesses and wealthy taxpayers governments need to finance their generous welfare states. Consider California. After revenues plunged during the 2008-09 financial crisis, Democrats rallied voters in 2012 to approve a supposedly temporary tax hike, which added three new income tax brackets and raised the top rate to 13.3%. From 10.3%. Several years later, Democrats asked voters to extend the tax hikes through 2030, which they did. A 2023 paper by Stanford economist Joshua Rall found that out-migration by California high earners accelerated after the 2012 hike. Reported taxable income by wealthy denizens who didn't leave also declined, perhaps because they used other means to shield their income from higher taxes or reduce their business activity in the state. The tax hikes thus raised 56% less revenue than expected. Farther north, Democrats in Washington state in 2021 enacted a 7% capital gains tax on high earners. The state otherwise has no personal income tax. Spending has outpaced revenue as rich Washingtonians, including Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, have left. To close a gaping budget hole, Democrats this past May raised the capital gains rate on top earners to 9.9%, increased the gross receipts tax on service businesses by 20%, hiked the estate tax to 35% from 20%, and expanded the sales tax. Yet the state's revenue estimates have declined by $412 million since the tax hikes were passed. So Democratic lawmakers are talking of hiking taxes again. Rinse and repeat. The problem with socialism, as Margaret Thatcher observed, is you eventually run out of other people's money. Eventually, Mr. Mandani will discover that too. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. We can't stop climate change, so we need to prepare for it. Adaptation doesn't mean defeat, but survival. It's time to embrace a third way, clear-eyed realism. By Alex Flint and Kaylee Creeder. We come from different backgrounds, politically, professionally, and personally. One of us is a Republican who has spent decades working with conservatives on energy and environmental policy. The other is a Democrat who has spent decades as an advocate for aggressive climate action, including years advising environmental organizations and working with Al Gore. We've often been on opposite sides of the same debate. But we now share an uncomfortable conclusion. Despite decades of dire projections about the climate, humanity has shown that it's unwilling to impose the limits on economic activity that would be necessary to keep global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius or even below 2 degrees. As global energy demand continues to grow, fossil fuel use remains dominant, and political commitments fall short of the necessary transformation. It isn't that society can't change, but that it won't. Around the world, people are giving priority to higher living standards, economic security, and access to affordable energy above a stable climate. That doesn't mean the climate movement's work has been in vain. Because of advocacy, technology development, and policy innovation, an energy transition is underway. The U.S. and many other nations have built cleaner energy sources and found more efficient ways of producing electricity, avoiding greenhouse gas emissions that once seemed inevitable. Globally, emissions per unit of economic activity has fallen consistently for over 50 years. But that improvement is more than offset by surging energy demand driven by population and economic growth. The net result is that emissions are likely to increase for another decade before stabilizing, which means atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases will climb through the end of the century. Mitigation. Efforts to reduce or prevent climate change won't keep global warming within safe limits. The best scientific models suggest that the planet is on track to warm roughly 3 to 3.5 degrees Celsius by 2100, and then to warm more in the next century. Compared with many other areas, population, life expectancy, and economic growth over decades, climate is easy to forecast. The physics of greenhouse gases, the inertia of our energy systems, and the pace of policy change all point to a relatively predictable climate trajectory. If that's the future we're headed toward, then our response must change. We don't advocate giving up on mitigation entirely. Reducing emissions remains essential for limiting the scale of the problem. We both believe in the incredible ingenuity of people and markets, but we must now direct at least as much creativity, investment, and political will toward adaptation. That means responding to climate effects as they happen, while also anticipating and preparing for them. We should prepare for extreme heat, floods, and vector-borne disease in places where they haven't yet occurred. We also need to consider changing where and how we grow crops and where people can safely live. The National Intelligence Council warned in 2021 that climate change will increasingly exacerbate risks to U.S. national security interests as the physical impacts increase and geopolitical tensions mount about how to respond. Climate change's effects on national security could mean the need for new security agreements, positioning troops in different parts of the world, and preparing for the disruption that will occur from large-scale human migration and conflict over scarce resources. The climate movement has long feared that talking about adaptation would signal defeat. But adaptation isn't surrender, it's survival. Many people will find the economic imperative to adapt and become resilient more compelling than the moral imperative to mitigate. An agenda focused on adapting can unite rather than divide. Unlike mitigation, which often provokes partisan battles over energy, regulation, and ideology, adaptation is rooted in practicality and shared human interest. Preparing for a changing climate can and should be bipartisan, much like national defense, which commands broad support because it protects lives, property, and national stability. In the same way, a coherent adaptation strategy is an act of collective self-defense against a threat we can neither ignore nor entirely prevent. For too long, the debate over climate change has been framed as a battle between denial and ambition, between doing nothing and doing everything. It's time to embrace a third way, clear-eyed realism. We must acknowledge what humanity is and isn't willing to sacrifice and plan accordingly. We wish that mitigation alone could save us from a warming world, but wishful thinking won't change human nature or the physics of our atmosphere. The climate is changing, and it's up to us to be prepared. Mr. Flint is Executive Director of the Alliance for Market Solutions and a former Republican Staff Director of the Senate Committee on Energy and National Resources. Ms. Kreider is a consultant and a former climate advisor to Al Gore. Letter to the editor, Marco Rubio, how we thwarted the UN's tax. When President Trump promised to put the American people first, the global elites decried his principled stance as isolationist and dangerous. As it turns out, what they feared was that he would rally nations around the world to reject self-destructive global governance schemes. That's what happened last week at the International Maritime Organization in London. The U.S. achieved a diplomatic victory and successfully rallied a coalition to stop the body's proposed net zero framework, a carbon tax on shipping whose revenue would be paid directly into a UN-controlled fund. This misguided initiative was a classic case of taxation without representation, a European-driven overreach that threatens U.S. consumers, businesses, and global trade. Thanks to the president's leadership and the unified efforts of his cabinet, we stopped it cold. By mobilizing IMO member states around shared concerns for economic security, we exposed the framework's flaws. A regressive tax that would burden developing nations and stifle growth. Our coalition building efforts paid off, proving that real diplomacy based on national interest, ours and theirs, can thwart unaccountable bureaucratic schemes. Should this initiative or any other similar one emerge from the UN bureaucracy again, our coalition against it will be ready and larger. President Trump is revitalizing U.S. diplomacy, putting the nation's interests first, and delivering tangible wins for the American people. But the administration isn't doing it alone. We're bringing countries together by identifying areas of mutual interest and delivering results. From brokering historic peace deals in the Middle East that build on the Abraham Accords, to forging stronger economic alliances in the Indo-Pacific to counter China's bullying, the president's approach has restored U.S. strength on the world stage. These successes demonstrate what happens when the U.S. leads with resolve. Adversaries back down, allies step up, and global stability improves without sacrificing our sovereignty. And that was by Marco Rubio, the U.S. Secretary of State. Letters to the editor continued. Will Congress ever step up? Stephen Valdeck makes some fine points in his October 16th letter, The Roberts Court and the Imperial President. Yet, it was neither the judiciary nor the executive that made the legislative branch irrelevant. Congress did that by itself by surrendering its constitutional responsibilities. Look at the present politics. Since 2011, Congress has passed 55 continuing resolutions and increased or suspended the debt ceiling 12 times. The government is currently shut down over its inability to agree to continue spending at last year's level. Our lawmakers made the administrative state and have since deferred to it. Power abhors a vacuum. The president is simply filling the one Congress created because it doesn't have the guts to do its job or to be held accountable for it. By Robert B. Bullis, Charleston, South Carolina. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 20th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening.
Holy cow! It's almost time for the Niagara Frontier.